Tell It to the World. Chapter 18. Giving the Child a Name. After hours of scrubbing over a hot soapy tub, a certain Adventist lady in the village of Jackson, Michigan, was taking down her washing one day when a close neighbor, who had frequently vented her spleen against Sabbath keepers, hurled a bucket of water out of her window and splashed mud all over her nice clean clothes.
You witch!
Cried the Adventist lady in a burst of tears, as she angrily yanked the clothes off the line for a second scrubbing. Inevitably the word spread, or rather, a different word spread. In those simple days, when the good name of the church was a primary concern of every member, a meeting to consider her case was convened at the home of blacksmith Dan Palmer, the local Adventist leader. H.S. Case and C.P. Russell, two of the numerous more or less self-appointed ministers of the day, rebuked the woman severely and accused her of using a certain word. This word, she just as strongly insisted, she had not used. Calmer minds soon suggested prayer. And while the group were on their knees, Ellen White, who was stopping by with her husband on their way west, received a vision. At Elder White's invitation, Russell and Case examined her carefully until they were convinced that her experience was authentic. When the vision closed, Mrs. White announced that God had unveiled the truth about the lady in question and that she had indeed done something wrong. Having revealed this much, however, Ellen found herself unable to recall any more. Case and Russell were jubilant. Emphatically, they declared themselves steadfastly confident in Sister White's divine gifts as a prophet, and demanded that the hapless woman confess. On Friday night, during family worship in another Adventist home, the same vision was repeated. On Sabbath morning, during the sermon at Dan Palmer's house, Mrs. White returned once more to the situation. The woman did do wrong, she repeated, but the Lord had also revealed, Ellen went on, that she had not used the specific word which Case and Russell had accused her of using. God had shown, moreover, that he was deeply displeased with the unkindness manifested by the two ministers and desired compassion instead. The reaction was remarkable. The woman melted into tears, confessed what she had done, and begged forgiveness. Russell and Case, on the other hand, complained indignantly about Mrs. White's unwarranted criticism of themselves and condemned her visions as totally unreliable. It was in this manner in June 1853 that the first offshoot from Sabbath-keeping Adventism was born. The two men soon inaugurated a new publication with which to attack the Whites and other leaders, and from its title, Messenger of Truth, they and their followers came to be called the Messenger Party. At that very time, James White was seriously ill from overwork. It seemed so likely that he would die that when in Battle Creek his first little house was built, he had the deed made out in the name of his wife. The messenger made merry over his malaise, citing it as crowning evidence that God would soon take him out of the way. When James read the messenger's uncharitable comments, his faith revived, and like Wycliffe of old he sat up in bed and exclaimed, I shall not die, but live, and declare the works of the Lord, and may yet preach at their funeral. For 2 long years loyal ministers felt it their duty to defend the Whites and the truth from the messenger's attacks. But after a vision on a Sabbath evening in Oswego, New York, in June 1855, Ellen White instructed them not to reply to the charges any longer, but to devote their time and energy to proclaiming truth, present truth. In the name of the Lord, she promised that if they would do this, the leaders of the offshoot would soon go to war among themselves. Their paper would expire, and their movement vanish. She also promised that when that time came, Adventists, if they followed God's counsel, would find that their own ranks had doubled. For a while it must have seemed that her words could never be fulfilled, for late that same year a second group separated out under the leadership of J.M. Stevenson and D.P. Hall. Their burden was that man's opportunity for salvation continues on during the age to come. That is, during the millennium, a belief which earned them the name the Age to Come Party. Stevenson and Hall had been won to the Sabbath when J.H. Wegener walked 50 miles specifically to teach it to them. At first they had condemned Russell and Case for the egregious exposition of doctrine in their messenger of error. But after a while Stevenson and Hall found that they agreed with Russell and Case in rejecting James White's leadership and Ellen White's visions, and so joined them. The messenger party appeared to be growing, not falling apart. But the brethren obeyed Ellen White's counsel. The messenger party, including its age-to-come auxiliary, did dissolve in due course, and on January 14, 1858, White reported in the review that subscriptions had increased in 3 years from 1,000 to 2,000. The final end of the editor of the Messenger was a somber one. Finding himself out of a job because he was out of readers, he went to teaching school to make a living. But not having learned first to govern himself, he failed utterly in governing his pupils. Angry with an unruly student, he pulled a gun on him. To escape lynching, he fled to parts unknown. Still another offshoot developed, in 1858, which, from its practice, might be designated the Smoke and Chew Party. The use of tobacco, though not yet a test of fellowship, was disparaged by most Sabbath keepers. A few believers, however, in the vicinity of Otsego, Michigan, found a minister to their liking, a certain Gilbert Cranmer, who encouraged them to keep both the Sabbath and their tobacco. In common with the Messenger and Age to Come people, they published a paper, The Hope of Israel, and vehemently denied the inspiration of Ellen White. Like them, too, they soon faded off the scene. To avoid returning to offshoots for a while, it may be added here that in 1865 the remnants of these three groups received a few reinforcements when elders B.F. Snook and W.H. Brinkerhoff were voted out of the leadership of the Iowa Conference. Snook and Brinkerhoff wanted a congregational, independent type of denominational structure and opposed Elder and Mrs. White with vigor. Because they made their headquarters in Marion, Iowa, they and their group came to be known as the Marion Party. Brinkerhoff soon resumed his practice of law, and Snook turned universalist. The movement still exists as the Church of God, Seventh Day, Denver, Colorado. Loughborough somewhere picked up the curious but not impossible legend that the four offshoots printed their papers on the same little hand press. According to the story, each successive group purchased it from its predecessor. The main body imposed no legal or economic sanctions on those who wished to leave. They could scarcely have done so even had they desired to. But there were some administrative implications involved which were hard to overlook. The defecting leaders of these various offshoots had become well known through the review during their loyal days, and they described themselves in distant communities as still being staunch supporters of the movement. Who was there to prove that they were not? Further, in 1854, when a large evangelistic audience overflowed a schoolhouse to hear John Loughborough preach, the question arose, why not use a tent? Local laymen promptly put up the money, and Merritt Cornell hopped on a train and returned with one in a matter of days. Soon believers in several states pooled their resources to purchase state tents to be used by itinerant preachers in their respective areas, and both attendance and baptisms rose encouragingly. In Wisconsin, the disaffected Age to Come and Messenger ministers took the state tent for their own use. And who was there to say that they couldn't? There were other problems too which required central organization. The only regularly dependable means of communication among the brethren was the review. If a minister felt impressed to travel to a certain area, he announced his intention in the church paper. When subsequent issues came out, he borrowed copies from whatever believer he happened to be stopping with at the time and looked for published replies from people who lived in the area to which he was headed. These letters, if any, told him where his services were most needed and where there was the most likelihood of success. Conversely, if the believers in an area desired the assistance of a certain minister, they let him know through the review. The following notice, for instance, appeared in the issue for January 21, 1858. Cannot bro, and Senior White, or BRN, Loughborough and Wagoner, or somebody else make an appointment for a meeting at Gilboa, Ohio, and give notice of it in the review? We have expected such an appointment at every mail for the last 6 weeks. Are there no bowels of compassion? TJB. Not without reason were the ministers referred to as traveling brethren. On riverboats and railroad cars, over corduroy, log, roads and icy trails, many of them rode, and often on foot they tramped back and forth, up and down, from Maine to Minnesota believing they were led by the Holy Spirit. Often no doubt they were so led. But God is not the author of confusion. Eager to finish the work, men accepted one urgent call after another, rushing from state to state without waiting to ascertain first whether their